So, very good morning, all of you, at 15th ESLE conference. Friends, I have a very non-simple kind of presentation to make. He had a very simple presentation because I am taking up, something which has become a very disturbing reality of today's context. And I think many of us may not be really appreciating what I'm going to talk today. So let me just give you a small, quick introduction of what I'm planning to do with this subject. You know, the idea of wrongful prosecution in terror-related cases is something what I'm going to discuss. You know, it is very unusual to cover this particular topic in the realm of terrorism studies, because terrorism studies are limited to different other aspects of issues. Whereas I'm looking at wrongful prosecution as a consequence of adjudication of terror cases, where we find that lots of people are behind the bar, not because of their criminality or because of their guilty. It is because of the wrongfulness of the process. You know, Brendan Garrett, when he wrote the book in 2002, Convicting the Innocent, when criminal prosecution goes wrong, when criminal justice goes wrong, when criminal prosecution goes wrong. So this book has created a kind of uproar in many jurisdictions, as it has very efficiently brought into light the dilemma and the plight of the victims who are behind the bars for no reason. So the idea is, when I say wrongful prosecution, I am essentially talking about those people who are exonerated by the judiciary after the trial. So it is about those cases where the people are arrested, prosecuted, tried in the court, and incarcerated for a substantial period of time, and later they are exonerated. So this is a common sight in many jurisdictions, that trial court convicts the people who are arrested in connection with terror cases, and these people are sent to jail, and by the time they prefer appeal to the higher court, a lot of time elapsed, and therefore, as a consequence, they end up serving a term which may range anywhere between a year up to 25 years. There are cases which have been recently decided in India and elsewhere where the accused have been released from the jails after serving a sentence of right up to 20 years, 23 years. Now, very little is provided in the law in terms of any measure of solace to these people. You know, when I say very little, I really mean nothing. Because law is not really very clear, nor there is any provision to compensate or to take care of their plight. Because it's a kind of victimization through the abuse of power on the part of these people. So, because they were never guilty. So in many cases, there are many factors. So I'll be one by one discussing and raise few questions with respect to this process. Friends, I am also trying to attract your attention. In the US, the Innocence Project is going on. Many of us are aware of the operation of Innocence Project. They are mainly dealing with wrongfully convicted people. So those who are convicted even by the apex court. So there are review commissions, like in UK they have already, appointed a review commission where even the plea of convicted people can be reopened. And it is DNA evidence thing is actually helping and re-establishing their innocence, and resultantly as many as more than 3,000 people have been released in past 3 to 5 years in the US. But I am not dealing with wrongfully convicted people. I am dealing with wrongfully prosecuted people. They are not necessarily convicted by the apex court. They are only convicted by the trial court. And these people have preferred appeal. So between the conviction by the lower court and the decision of the appeal by the apex court, the time which is taken and the shocking stories have come to the light, where you will see the factors which are responsible for this state of affair, is so shocking that you will know that the quality of investigation, the basis on which they have been arrested, tried and convicted, those grounds are, you know, flimsy enough to raise a lot of suspicion. So therefore, I am actually saying what Hoffman said, that the compliance with legal norms has become a matter of executive grace. So police has become a kind of agency. Yesterday I was intervening in a paper and I said that in most places, unfortunately, what we gather is the efficiency of the law enforcement agency is seen in terms of its capacity to make arrests. So as long as police is making arrest, we think the police is effective. And more so in terror cases, what happens is terror cases, you know, generally they shock the people. They create a lot of fear psychosis among the public. And public want an immediate response. And therefore, police is sometimes pressurized to swing into action. So immediately they will try to have few scapegoats. And they arrest few people. And who are arrested? The people who are likely to be arrested are those who have some kind of tainted background, who are of a particular minority in certain places, or who have some track record of criminality in the past. Not necessarily these factors should become a whole criteria of, you know, making the people arrested. So in connection with these cases, the people are arrested. And you will find the different, you know, the result may be acquittal. So in most cases, if you see, the rate of acquittal in these cases is very high, and conviction is anywhere between 1 to 2%. Now this is very shocking. Only 2% cases result into conviction. Even when acquittal happens, you will see that it becomes a sort of punishment without crime. Because I have seen, because I am actively pursuing these cases, and I have heard the plea of these people who got finally acquitted. I attended some public tribunal and I have heard personally these people who have, you know, come out from the jails after 10 years, 20 years. And the testimonies that they have given are revealing. I think a true criminological investigation is due in these cases to understand the victimization of these people. And what they say that though we have been acquitted, but when they go to the society, nobody accepts this fact that having served 20 years or 10 years, you come clean. So there is this rejection, there is an inherent social rejection which become too difficult for these people to really get rehabilitated in the society. Therefore, I'm saying that these experiences are a sort of a gross human rights violation resulting from illegal detention. Torture, incarceration and unfair trial are the key words which define the entire state of affairs. I'll just try to portray how these factors play out really in the process of wrongful prosecution. And this trial process in the anti-terror cases, it amounts to then punishment for the accused even before they are found guilty. Now, just coming to Indian scenario, India is the biggest democracy, sincerely following the rule of law, you know, doctrine, and that's why the terror cases are always subjected to very tough review in India. And twice or thrice these laws have been really thrown out based on the constitutional reviews. But if you see that the cases of wrongfully prosecuted are on the rise, and this is, you know, revealed from the recent testimonies from the people who have come out. And a very less percentage of those arraigned under the anti-terror laws are convicted, as I said. So 2%, less than 2% is precisely the extent to which... Now, I am talking about this entire idea of the present paper is to underline the susceptibility to the wrongful process in Indian terror laws. In fact, any terror laws, this is my form submission, becomes little susceptible to the compromises of the with respect to the rule of law, because so many go-bys are given in terms of the standard criminal procedure is concerned. So the entire gamut of anti-terror legislation has a very different set of provisions in relation to the standard criminal law, especially if you see the provisions relating to the bail, the arrest. So I'm trying to just look at certain factors. So first of all, if you look at even the definition of terrorism, which is provided in UAPA, this is called the Unlawful Activities Act. And in this act, they say that even the likelihood of causing terror in the minds of people comes within the ambit of the terror activity. Likelihood of causing. Now, this is a very vague construction, to target the people. So it is very easy to really allege the people under this provision. And therefore, lot of powers. So the investigating agencies are really very powerful. Now, the two very important aspects of this power issue is, one is that they can arrest the people merely based on their suspicion or their involvement in the so-called terrorist activities. That is one. Second, the confession made before the police officer become a very valid evidence in the court of law. It is acceptable. So in general standard criminal law, the confession made before a police officer is not tenable. It's not sustainable. But in the anti-terror laws, what we see is that this confession becomes admissible. And this is the whole reason of all kinds of problems with respect to this. Because then there is an issue of forced confession. Then there is an issue of torture. I'll see how. But what I'm saying is the entire process results into a kind of over-criminalization, what we are seeing. Now, this over-criminalization is a kind of, passion, or I would say a kind of activity through which a lot of people are putting behind the bar for no reason. Now, there is a strong argument going against the very process of over-criminalization in many places. And if you see the Douglas Hushak or, Duff, they have written a lot against all these things. So let us see how these things really tend to play. So, as I said, the detention without charge sheet for up to 180 days and police custody can be up to 30 days. That is the most crucial clause which provides lot of power with the police, and they can really arrest the people and keep them in custody and utilize some pressure tactics well up to 180 days without charge sheet. Now this is a kind of very, very serious thing to watch. And 2-3 observations. It creates a strong presumption against bail, and anticipatory bail is out of question. So bail is generally very liberally granted in ordinary cases in India. But bail in cases relating to terror is just difficult. So without bail, the people will continue to suffer or languish in the jail for so many years. Lots of movies have been made, and Mumbai is very known for filmmaking. Shahid, and all those films. If you have not watched, please watch. A wonderful movie, which talks about the plight of a person who is suspected for a terror case, and the kind of targeting that he has experienced, the kind of blame that he suffered, and the kind of the attitudes which are finally expressed against. And anticipatory bail is just not possible. And a strong presumption of guilt of terrorism offences merely based on the evidence allegedly seized. Now, it is very interesting to note that in many cases the evidences which are relied by the police are so flimsy. You know, in many cases, if you are following the cases in that this part of the country, you'll find in one case a piece of paper was recovered. A famous case when Akshardham temple was targeted. So, Suleiman. So, from his pocket, a piece of paper was recovered which mentions some addresses in a particular country. So, therefore, now this is, and the body was blood-ridden, but the paper was clean. So, a lot of contradictions are such noticed. So, even in many cases, you'll find the grounds on which the arrests are made are quite, you know, unconvincing. So, departure, which gives excessive power to the investigating agencies and curtailed already downward adjusted civil liberties of the accused. And also, the increased duration of police custody and detention during the investigation under this law is another thing which we need to look at. The standard bail provisions not being applicable to the accused and sloping towards the denial of bail. So, bail is not possible. Now, what are the important factors? Now, let us look at the wrongful prosecution from this perspective. And here we find that the conviction rate has been disproportionately low in these cases. And in the earlier version of, TADA, which is the anti-terror laws, now it stands repealed. In all these 77,000 plus cases, the conviction rate was well below 1%, and factors which we can look at are very interesting to note. The fabricated evidence, as I just mentioned. So in Malegaon blast case, which is a very famous case, infamous case rather, well, we will find that call records between the accused, the call records. The acquitting court noted that even if the recording was admitted to be true, the content of call records had nothing, no link, the accused in bomb blast. So call is something which people ordinarily make to so many countries. So making call to any countries merely cannot be a kind of independent evidence to be able to convict a person in a case of bomb blast. This is what the court said in this particular case. And also, the prosecution does not even produce the evidence for the most crucial allegation. This is what the court said. In Makkah Masjid blast case, very recently decided, even where the entire case rests on obtaining the fake passport was the whole issue. The evidence of the prosecution neither included the passport nor the application form of the passport or any document relating to such charge. So now the lack of evidence in normal criminal justice course, these evidences cannot be sustained by the court to be able to convict a person. But peculiarly enough, in terror cases, a kind of implication is drawn, which becomes so peculiar in these cases that these are very difficult to defend then. And in Mumbai train blast case, 7-11, again, Wahid Sheikh was prosecuted on the basis of his association to SIMI, which is a banned organization, and the confession was obtained under duress and torture. Now, there are lots of cases which I have heard since I am working on this particular topic these days. Invariably, the experiences of forced confession in such cases are too frequent. And merely based on that confession, a person can be convicted directly. And confession before the police only. It's not confession before any judicial magistrate or anybody else. And then, the reliance on confession is another issue, as I am repeatedly saying. So, they reject, in many cases which were decided by the apex court later, where the Supreme Court rejected the confession due to the lack of corroborative evidence. I remember Nisar Ahmed case, who got acquitted, I think it is there, after 23 years. He was convicted based on a piece of paper which was produced before the court, which was allegedly, taken as his confession by the police. So Nisar Ahmed said that I don't know English or Hindi or any other language, so I'll write my confession in Urdu. So he has written the confession in Urdu. It was taken as confession. He was tried by the trial court and convicted. After 23 years, the Supreme Court decoded that piece of paper and found that he is writing, I am not saying what the police is asking me to write. This is not I am admitting. So this is what he wrote instead of the confession. So this is the story of these cases which become so, shocking. Now, in serial, train bombing case of 6 and 7 December, the Mohammad Nisaruddin case, this was a very sensational case. And I think this case is enough to bring a very powerful critique of the contemporary criminal law, especially the way the criminal law works with respect to terror cases. And the only evidence against him was custodial confession without any independent witness. Now, this is the story of wrongful prosecution. And I question this thing because I fail to understand that the trial court has enough opportunity to marshal evidence, enough opportunity to apply its judicial mind on the question of evidences adduced before the court. But invariably, you'll find that at times these cases are very mechanically disposed and then they become what we call wrongful prosecution. Torture is also a very integral part of this entire process. And if you see the forms of torture experienced by the victims of wrongful prosecution, they present a shocking tale. So in most cases, the victims, we heard these people, their testimonies, which we are bringing in the form of a paper now. So there, all these things become part and parcel. But again, so sometimes they are made to stand for 4 days, chained, not allowed to sleep, kept in isolation, lot many things. But what I am saying is the delayed trial and investigation is the major reason. Because if these cases are quickly decided in the appellate court, probably the trauma of staying in prison without being found guilty could be reduced. And therefore, the long periods, the incarceration becomes then, the sole consequence. The nature of charges in terror cases, the public sentiment whipped up by the media, and the legal provision in anti-terror laws all work to ensure that even if deserving, the accused application for discharge and bail are not entertained. So there is a strong sense of when yesterday we heard Packer, so he says that probably the state ideology and the ideology of criminal justice system changes drastically when it comes to, exercising the discretion by the police. So sometime if you subscribe to crime control model, probably the public expectation of seeing quick result become the sole guiding factor on the part of law enforcement agency to act quickly in these cases, compromising the rule of law and the due process entitlement. So many of such accused, they also suffer on account of poor legal representation. We have so many cases where you'll find the quality legal aid is not available to the defendant. So it becomes a major reason. In many places, many lawyers just refuse to, represent them in the court of law because they are involved in a case which challenges the country's, integrity. So sedition-like cases or terrorism cases, finding the legal quality legal aid is another issue. And in many places, we see that delayed investigation by the officer grant them an opportunity to concoct this story as they want. And essentially what we are saying that delayed prosecution means weakened prosecution has lesser chances of finding credible witness and evidences. So in such cases, not many witnesses or evidences are presented from the defendant side, and therefore you'll find ultimately incarceration becomes the only consequence. And I'm also saying, this is something which is emerging from the paper, that it's not merely the error of technical judgment or a wrong judgment on account of which the wrongful prosecution is happening. I'm taking a very strong line here, but I cannot help but saying this, that it is a structural outcome. When I say structural outcome, I say it is something inherent in the anti-terror laws and the structure of criminal justice system, which deals with anti-terror laws. So sometimes, because the agencies enjoy a lot of impunity in dealing with the cases of terror, like no police officer can be prosecuted for wrongful prosecution because they are working under an impunity clause. But I don't know whether it is a deliberate implication of the accused in many cases, or it is because of the way criminal justice functions. These two things to be researched. I think this is the high time then we should research these particular things. I remember when I interacted with the colleagues in Center for Criminology at Oxford University, they organized one program at NLU Delhi, When Criminal Justice Goes Wrong. They also subscribed to this idea that it's not that we are alleging the criminal justice system to be biased, but it is somehow inherent or integral to the way the criminal justice system functions, the way police function, the way the prosecution function. So if we are talking about balance, if we are talking about the upholding of the rule of law, all these things become very, very important. Please alert me when my time is up.
A lot of time because
there are only two speakers. No, third speaker.
Huh. Oh, I'm sorry.
So I'll cut my time.
Yes. But still we have time.
The third speaker has appeared.
Thank you. Quite quickly.
Okay. So really to conclude the presentation, I would emphasize that this is a very silent type of victimization which is going on. This is invisible victimization. Because generally these people, instead of protesting, they celebrate that they have finally come out from jail. So therefore, not much is brought into light as a way of problem. But don't you seriously think, this is the question mark, don't you seriously think that the present laws, the present system of justice do not have any support mechanism or any law or any entitlement which can alleviate or mitigate the sufferings of this particular clause? I strongly advocate that there is need to recognize the rights of the wrongfully prosecuted people. Because unless you identify and recognize certain kinds of rights to be provided to these people, probably the legal obligations cannot be cast on the law enforcement agency, or for that matter on the criminal justice agency. Because all said and done, what is required is to see that having come out from the jail, these persons should not be met with a sense of social rejection, which I have noticed. The sons and daughters of these people do not get admission because they are treated as a kind of suspected people, though they are acquittal. It's not a kind of discharge, it's acquittal. So they have been acquitted by the court. But this acquittal doesn't help because society disbelieves them. So this victim blaming, this stigma and this stigmatization is the real offshoot of this entire, you know, process, what I call wrongful prosecution. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Bashpai. Our last speaker is Professor Heru Susetio. I'm so sorry, I didn't know that you're in the room.
He
so,
is just
do you want to move forward, or do you feel comfortable presenting from there?
Up to you. I can.
Okay. So you'll have so you have 15 minutes, please.
which is
Morning,
Professor.
Hello, how are you?
Good morning. Sorry,
nice
I can't wait.
It's all right. Can I have a water? Water.
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 Water cooling.
Water?
My topic is related to the terrorism. It's more
around
criminological approach of terrorism and the type of constructing terrorism, socially and politically constructed crime.
Sunset
class and I'd like to take a sample of from Indonesia and other countries as well. So because terrorism is not just a legal things or but also political things and social things, and so we need to take a look what about the social and economic approach to terrorism. Yes, terrorism can be socially and politically constructed as well. And we have a lot of problems in terrorism actually, not just in legal terms, but also how to define terrorism, how to define the victims, who is the victim actually. What about the family of the terrorists are also victims or perpetrators? Some people regard them as perpetrators and the other regard them as the victims. And how to define perpetrators also? Sometimes people who belong to liberation movement are regarded as terrorists from the central government. However, on the other hand, if he is belong to the government or can the state sponsor terrorism, can the state, and can a country instigate a terrorism still, instigate a big debate actually. So in the case of Indonesia, there are two different regions, namely in Poso. Poso is a region in central Sulawesi, belong to Sulawesi Islands, and the other place is Papua. Papua is another island in the eastern part of Indonesia. And there are two groups, the two armed groups, the first one in central Sulawesi in Poso, the other one in Papua. And the Indonesian Terrorism Anti-Terrorism Agency frequently tell to the media that the Poso group is terrorist, while the Papua group is not terrorist. They are convinced to the media that the Papua group is Spanish group, while the Poso group is terrorist. So people are quite confusing about the terms. Why the Poso is classified as terrorist, while the first Papua is not terrorist. And even the head of the chief of the BNPT, BNPT is the anti-terrorist agency, he told the media on Monday, 23 June 2012, and said the mastermind of violence in Papua is terrorist group. He is the chief of the anti-terrorist agency, that's like this. The mastermind of violence of Papua is Spanish group, while in Poso is terrorist. So it's quite different between separatists and terrorists. Another case took place in Tangerang in